welcome to the Bulwark Daily. I'm your host, Tim Miller. It is Monday, so of course we have editor-at-large Bill Kristol. Hey, Bill.
Hey, Tim. How are you?
I'm doing well. I've got some announcements for people real quick. Tickets for the live shows, ACC Country, are on sale. Bill is going to be with us in Atlanta. You know, we're going to do Atlanta stuff while we're there, so get your tickets now. We have, I think, a really exciting guest. I don't want to jinx it, coming in Charlotte. Not that Bill's not exciting for Atlanta. He is.
I can take it. I can take it. I'm not, you know, offended. It's just, I'm happy to be second banana is me, you know?
I think people will be excited about the Charlotte guest. And I'm planning on getting a little loose. I got one of my buddies coming in Columbia. So any of the shows will be a win. Get your tickets to thebulwark.com/events. Last week, Bill and I discussed that the Labor Day pod be a retrospective on 1994 and 2006, and then also kind of a look ahead to this midterms, sort of a wave year special episode. We heard a lot of feedback that people want that. So I'm getting my Harriet Meyer stories ready. Bill's refreshing his memory about 1994. I got this t-shirt brought to me. My former pod co-host Cameron Caskey brought this to me. This is a Operation Desert Storm t-shirt. So, you know, that was freedom and justice for all, you know, so we're kind of getting in the 90s spirit for Bill Kristol.
Thank you, Tim. I'm pleased you didn't have a World War II t-shirt for me, or World War I, you know, Spanish-American War.
Operation Desert Storm, the good old days. Anyway, so that's all coming up. Today's show, you know, the world is so strange. I guess we're going to start with war. If we're going to do some Operation Desert Storm references, we'll start with the war being back on-ish in Iran. There was an exchange of fire in the Strait of Hormuz yesterday. First, U.S. forces struck Iranian launchers on Larak Island. The rockets were allegedly, according to Central Command, set to disperse sea mines into the strait. Now, that is interesting because the administration was bragging to Axios just like 36 hours prior to that the seas were open. Seas were open. And you know the seas are open when you've got to bomb the launchers that have the sea mines on them. That's a great sign that seas are open. The insurance companies love that. Hours later, Iran retaliated by firing a few missiles towards Jordan, all of which were intercepted. We are kind of running out of interceptors, though, so partial good news there. That is the state of play. Meanwhile, there's also a leak with some warnings from top generals, military leaders advising Hegseth that prolonging large-scale operations in Iran's unsustainable, at risk weakening their ability to confront threats everywhere. There are too many troops there, 50,000. The warnings came from the head of the Army, Navy, and Air Force, and four-star commanders overseeing U.S. operations in Europe, Asia, and Latin America. That was quite the leak to the Washington Post. So that's the state of play.
Honestly, it's good that some in the military or someone in the Defense Department, I suppose, or maybe elsewhere in the government, the National Security Council, are revealing certain things to us, since the military, the Defense Department, has been utterly unrevealing about anything that's happened. Very struck by this recent report. You know, people who were in the military are getting more and more alarmed and also outraged about what's happened to our bases there. For example, something we've discussed before, and the degree to which the damage that was done to huge U.S. hubs by Iranian drones disabling them. And we know that that's why, you know, the sailors on the USS Lincoln couldn't get the provisions and all that.
Particularly base in Bahrain, the naval.
Yes,
support
it's a huge, yeah. It's our biggest, I think maybe our biggest naval base anywhere, or certainly abroad or anywhere in the region, certainly. And the idea that it just gets put out of commission, basically. And then, of course, we're not told about it. And they sort of mislead everyone about it. And, oh, we're dominant. We're winning. It's a slaughter of the Iranians. And anyway, yeah, it's bad.
Yeah, just on this was as Captain John Cordell, retired captain, like wrote about this in Military Times. But, you know, it's basically saying that the more we learn about the attacks on the NSA, the Naval Support Base in Bahrain during the opening days of Operation Epic Fury, the clearer it becomes why the news of its near destruction was not initially reported or acknowledged, extensive damage, et cetera, et cetera. The base is more damaged than acknowledged. Casualties, or at least the injuries, the number of injured troops, more than they were initially acknowledging. And, you know, some of this, anytime in war, like there's some element of this where, like, you don't want to, you know, signal like, hey, we're really fucked in Bahrain, right? Like there's some strategic reasons to not do this, but this feels like more than that, especially when you listen to ex-military people, as far as the degree to which they've been hiding the ball.
And you put it on top of all the lying about the strait is open and we're winning and they're decimated. They have no capacity left to use anything, to do anything anywhere. And then suddenly they're launching missiles at Jordan, you know, again.
And it is true, like the blockade of the Iranian ships does seem to be having some impact. If you look at reports on the Iranian economy. So that is not wholly made up. Like there's something to that. And who knows what like pressure that could end up putting on them. And like ships have been being able to get through the Strait of Hormuz recently, but it's just not anywhere near the pre-war rate. And, you know, again, we're not anywhere near any sort of actual sustainable deal, obviously, based on the missiles firing over the weekend.
Yeah, and based on just the fact that everyone in the Middle East and around the world, as we can see from different reports, is adjusting to this new reality where we were unable to impose our will on Iran, unable to keep the strait open, unable to keep it open going forward without some degree of bowing to Iranian demands and pressure. The nuclear program is whatever it was, you know, it hasn't changed. You know, I mean, there's not suddenly the Iranians not hurrying to the table to assure us that they're giving up their nuclear weapons. Trump stopped demand, you know. So it's a failed war, and failed wars have real consequences.
Average gas price is still over $4 a gallon, too. So negative impacts here. On that Washington Post thing, more threats from the administration to crack down on the leakers. I was a serious leak. Right. But like across the board, you just continue to see assaults on, you know, on free speech, on efforts to communicate the truth about the administration. Trump was threatening Kristen Welker ridiculously over the weekend. Like we've just continued to see like a lot of examples of this from the administration.
Right. And then also hiring people there at the Defense Department who are...
Oh, we're going to get to those guys.
Okay.
We're saving them in the middle. We'll come back.
I can't keep track of all the thuggishness at DOD. It is terrible. I just want to... We'll come back to maybe Hegseth also, since we all have such a low opinion of him. But having a thug running the Defense Department, I mean, is bad, really bad for the country in so many ways, in foreign policy and at home. I think it's really come home, hasn't it? I feel like I've always been, of course, critical of Hegseth, but as you have, but I feel like it's really come home in the, well, of course, the war does that, right? And then in the last month or two or three, just across the board, how damaging and dangerous it is.
Yeah, an incompetent thug at that.
Yeah.
You know, not even like really a skilled one. Speaking of thuggishness in foreign policy, the Venezuela oil deal over the weekend is total madness. I just want to read some. This is from the Wall Street Journal's report on this. The U.S. government is going to take a direct financial stake in a private company, private-ish, that would be granted century-long rights to some of the world's largest proven oil reserves in Venezuela and tie us to the unelected government in Venezuela, the Delcy Rodriguez, you know, coup government that we put in. The U.S. would take a 35% passive stake in this company. It's run by Alejandro Betancourt, and we'd secure preferential rights to purchase 20% of its production at cost. Betancourt did face criminal investigations of alleged money laundering in Spain and Switzerland. So that's the guy that we're all going into business with. It's the U.S. government. And the substance agreement is in direct conflict with Venezuela's constitution. And the coup was also in in violation of the constitution. And then private like oil companies in America are going, what are we supposed to do now? Like we're going to be competing against the government that is, you know, pillorying the foreign country and taking some of the oil at cost. Why would we do that? Like, what is the stability here? What happens when Trump's gone? What happens if Rodriguez is gone? Like, it is really a crazy deal to have the U.S. like be part of a state-run, essentially, oil company in Venezuela.
I mean, I think the odds of anything real happening there are pretty low. I mean, you know, this is, as you say, it's like Trump's negotiating something that the next U.S. government's not going to feel that it should go ahead with, and the interim government of Venezuela is negotiating something that's not democratically legitimate or any, you know, approved by some assembly there or anything real. So, but it's undercutting U.S. companies. Don't you think it's mostly, it's a PR stunt? I mean, it might have some effect, and I guess reassuring markets that there's plenty of oil, so they shouldn't. None of that oil, incidentally, can come to the market for years. I mean, so it won't affect current prices. Maybe it reassures people that we're not drawing down the oil reserves quite as much as we are, or that they'll be filled up again in 2 or 3 or 4 years with this oil from Venezuela. But it's a PR stunt. It's to make it look like everything's working out. You remember that Venezuela one? That one went better than Iran. And now, look, we've got a good deal on oil, but...
I mean, a socialist PR stunt, I guess. I, yeah, I mean, part of it is he's saying this is going to help refill up the reserves that we've been draining. And I think that there is maybe like some kind of market bullying like they were doing at the beginning of the Iran war, like a feeling like, oh, you know, there's going to be increased supply into the market. And, you know, that puts downward pressure on the prices. But I mean, like, there's so many ways to criticize the insanity. I mean, it's like we're doing imperialism again, you know, like it's the 1800s. And it's also like we're getting in business with a corrupt, illegitimate, really Venezuelan socialist government and like a corrupt favored businessman of the socialist government that did alleged crimes, you know, in Europe. It is just a completely unacceptable like way for us to do business. And I don't know. And I think that Trump, I guess, bets that it's like too complicated for people to get and that the right wing that would be, you know, up in arms if it was Barack Obama getting into business with a socialist government, you know, just betting correctly that they're not going to push back on it.
I guess. I also don't know how much people believe it. I do feel like, don't you think, I'm curious what you think. The Iran war, I feel like it's been so bad.
Yeah.
So there've been so many lies and it's gone so badly and the real world effects are so obviously bad, ranging from gas crisis at home to the, you know, geostrategic implications in the Middle East and abroad. I think Trump's effort, desperate efforts to kind of save it or in this case, to, you know, distract to Venezuela and see that one's working out well. I don't know. I feel like it's not going to work, actually. Do you think politically? I mean, here at home?
I mean, I don't know that it will actually work politically, no. I do think that it is like setting a dangerous precedent for us to be going back to this type of foreign policy, right? Yeah. I mean, for the future, assuming that there's a future Rubio or Vance administration, like this is like now an acceptable part of the toolkit. I think that's concerning. And, you know, I think that for Trump, in kind of more of an amorphous way, you know, if he ever is able to get back on a positive foot politically to be able to like kind of position himself as like a deal maker, like, look what I did in Venezuela. Like, I got us all the oil. Like, I told you these other guys were stupid. They took us to a war in Iraq and they never got the oil and I did it. I think it probably doesn't work, but I think it's still pretty appalling and ground that's worth fighting over. Of course.
Oh, very much so. And I think it's really damaging. I mean, I say this as someone who spent my college and grad school years, you know, arguing against all these Marxist or kind of quasi-Marxist historians who were great critics of American imperialism. It was all based on economic interests. And there were cases, obviously, in the 20s and 30s where that was very much the case. Yeah. And some of it's still in the 50s and 60s, United Fruit and all that. We discussed that a few weeks ago. But it's all about rapacious, you know, corporations and governments and crony capitalism and crooks basically getting rich off imperialism. Now, whatever one thinks of U.S. foreign policy since then, I think we're pretty innocent of that. I mean, that, you know, obviously Iraq was a mistake and terrible cost and all that, but it wasn't for the sake of, as you say, taking their oil. Quite the contrary, we were so proud when they voted, you know, in their first democratic election there with the purple fingers. Remember that and all that in 2004 right. Yeah, sure. And 5. What's happened incidentally to all the democracy we're supposed to be bringing to Venezuela? I haven't noticed an election being is an election being teed up there. I don't think we are.
And Marco, I don't think cares about that.
Getting the American public to support doing things abroad, it's obviously costly and not in anyone's immediate interest. You can't really prove that you have to do these things. Getting other nations to support us, that does require having some sense that it's a good faith effort to improve the situation there, as well as improve our own strategic situation, obviously. And in that respect, Trump has just given all that moral high ground away. And you could say, well, moral high ground, what's that worth? But it is worth something, actually, both at home and abroad.
I will say it. You can confirm whether or not this is in your words, but they're making the Marxist professors that were criticizing it right. They're making them correct.
You're right.
Like their critique was correct. And again, there are long-term potential unintended consequences to that. It was something I was thinking about this morning. Like the Venezuelan people, for a while, there was this fake nonsense where, you know, we were putting people in gulags because we were so concerned that there were Venezuelan gangs, Frente Aragua, invading the country. And it's like, okay, but if we're that concerned about that, wouldn't this potentially, you know, incite future hard feelings or future like desires to, you know, get back at the United States, you know, if there are these scary gangs in Venezuela? And so now we're going to, you know, kind of just basically rape their country of their resources and take it. There are consequences to that that are sometimes, you know, not necessarily direct and predictable. We're just going to stick on the Department of War propaganda she mentioned. The next thing I had in my notes was Laura Loomer, and I'm not ready to talk about her yet. I gotta keep getting my dander up a little bit more on Monday morning, then we'll get to Laura. So as you mentioned, the Pentagon is, Will Sommer actually, credit to Will, our colleague, basically broke the story because there was like this drama. People go listen if you missed it. Me and Will talked, I think, about this last week, but this drama, you know, burst out into the public between a high mid-level political appointee in the government and this Twitter person named Data Republican, and they started attacking each other on social media. And through that kerfuffle, it became revealed that Data Republican was this like sock puppet anonymous online account that was always posting pro-Trump stuff, was actually on the payroll of the government, of the Department of War, Department of Defense, heads up was paying her. And then Will, you know, and others started to kind of pull some strings and realize it's not just Data Republican. There are a bunch of these. And the Washington Post report over the weekend kind of expanded on Will's reporting and has this: the Pentagon secretly installed several conservative military veterans with large online followings in government roles, didn't disclose their assignments as they amplified Hegseth's viewpoints and attacked those who scrutinized the Trump administration. By the way, among the people that they had them attacking was Army Secretary Dan Driscoll, because of the internal fighting within the administration. A few of these Pentagon employees that were posing as independent, whatever, journalists, content creators, include Rob Manis, a retired colonel, and Kurt Schlichter, a longtime Bulwark critic who's also Hugh Hewitt's substitute host on Salem Radio. So, Bill, I mean, this is pretty crazy. Like the Department of Defense using our taxpayer dollars to have secret propagandists that are meant to propagandize us, not like the Iranian people.
Doesn't this remind us of other places, other nations around the world and other regimes at other times using the civilians, using the military as propagandize their own people? I mean, it's terrible, really. And that's something we've been pretty good. Again, it justifies all the critics, the past critics of America. You know, there have been instances of this a little bit, of course, in the past. And this shows how corrupt our whole system is. The achievement of building up a reasonably apolitical and unpropagandistic military, mostly, over the last few decades is really an achievement, right? It's an important part of what it means to live in a free country and a liberal democracy. And again, this is just being tossed away.
Also, these guys, I mean, I don't think that the Kurt Schlichters of the world had any integrity before, but like, shouldn't Salem Radio have to say something about this? I mean, Hugh Hewitt's guest host was on the payroll of the government and not revealing it, not telling anyone. And it's one thing to just be propagandizing for Trump just because you like it or because you want attention. That's not great. But to be doing it and be financially benefiting from it with our money. My taxpayer dollars is going to pay for Kurt Schlichter's erectile dysfunction pills. I don't like that. And I would think that Salem would have to say something about it in town hall.
It was kind of a horrifying image you just put him on in my mind.
Sorry, Kurt Schlichter, for people who don't understand the background, has been long posted about people at the Bulwarks. Sorry, Bill Kozier's dicks. Like he is very big about attacking us as cucks and blah 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 and like wimpy and like the MAGA men are the real men, which to me means you're overcompensating for something. And like now he's been taking secret taxpayer money.
No, it is terrible. And again, if we had a Congress, it could look into this, I suppose, and maybe they will if one or both houses change control in November. They could look into it. You know, this continuing resolution is coming up, and when the Senate gets back and since week and a half, 2 weeks, I guess, they have to resolve the House and Senate version. So someone's going to have to vote for something to continue funding the federal government.
Yeah.
Why are we funding this? I mean, shouldn't the Democrats say this is this tiny little thing? It's only a few million dollars, but you know what? No funding for any of this. And also no funding, needless to say, for all the horrible things ICE is doing, and no funding for a bunch of other things, I would say. But I mean, I feel like people are sort of passively saying, well, Trump won the election, so I guess we have to accept this. Really?
Thank you, Bill. Let's talk about that. Before we get to Congress, just one more to our friend Hugh Hewitt. I'm just waiting to hear about your statement, your position on your guest host being a secret propagandist to the government, because I mean, I guess Hugh Hewitt's been a propagandist for Trump for 10 years now, but I would think that this would cross some journalistic threshold over there at Salem, though I'm not holding my breath. Your point on the House: Congress has been on vacation for 5 weeks, the House. Great summer. I mean, you know, everybody needs a vacation. I took a vacation 2 weeks this year. I thought it was pretty generous for myself. You took a 1 week vacation, but you know, we're working in the private sector. Okay. Congress has been off for 5 weeks. Again, they're taking our money as well, not just Kurt Schlichter. And they're coming back to pass this budget that you mentioned, or this continuing resolution to avoid a government shutdown. And then their plan is to go back on vacation. I just don't know why the Democrats would not just absolutely do everything possible to, you know, put sticks in the gears of this plan. Like, these guys should not just be allowed to come here, like, basically under the cover of darkness, pass a budget, and then go back and hang out at Bedminster and go golfing again for a couple more weeks. And these are public servants. Maybe if they want to jam it through with all Republican votes on a party line vote, then make them do that, I guess. And maybe that will be what happens. We'll have to see. But from the Democrats, I would be, you know, using every procedure possible on the House floor to raise the issues you just laid up. And right, I mean, the fact that we're secretly funding MAGA propagandists with our taxpayer dollars, the ICE killings. What about the ballroom? What about the ARC? What about the stupid war in Iran? I mean, no funding for any of this. I'm sorry. And like, using the ability they have in the 2 days or whatever it is that they're in D.C., you would think that they should be going maximum pressure applied.
Totally. They should scream bloody murder, and they should oppose adjournment resolutions and all the different things they can do. There's more you can do in the Senate and the House. I guess the idea is the House will pass the Senate CR this week and get out of town, and that's the easiest way for them to do it. But yes, they should fight bloody. I was on a call just the other day, and it was, you know, after November, we really have to stop some of this stuff. You know, you could try to stop some of it now, right? You may not succeed, but put them on the spot. Let all these Republicans vote for this, for propagandizing for the Defense Department.
We've been complaining about this for a couple of weeks now. Have you heard any compelling pushback to this, like, to our point of view?
I think the only argument, the political argument, is the Democrats are doing well in the midterm elections. Risking a government shutdown throws a, you know, unpredictable spanner into the works, and let's just let good enough be well enough, however you say that, and not mess around too much, and let people go home and campaign, and we're doing okay in these campaigns. A little bit of prevent defense, I would say, 2 months out.
Yeah, I'm not compelled by that. I'm not compelled by that. Let's talk about the state of play and assess that. There's a poll that you flagged from a UMass Amherst. Just over one-fifth, 21% of Trump voters now express second thoughts about their vote. 1 in 6, 16%, now say they would change their 2024 vote if given the opportunity. I'm always kind of a little bit skeptical of these kinds of polls, and like, they're a little bit self-selecting. But even if it's half that, right, that's still a pretty meaningful number. And it's meaningful in particular, and this is why I'm not keen on prevent defense, because the places that they need to win are places Trump won by 11, 12, 13%. Like, that's the difference between having a good year and having a 1994 year, which we get to next week, right? It's like, can you win in these places that Trump won by 12, 13%, both in the House and, most importantly, though, in the Senate? Iowa, Ohio, Alaska, Texas, maybe Kansas, maybe whatever, Florida, Mississippi, whatever. Can you win in enough of those places to make it a real wave? And, you know, that UMass Amherst poll basically says that, like, that's in play, but it's not there.
Yeah, totally. I had the exact same reaction to it when I saw it last night. You know, it was embargoed for this morning, but now it's out. So, yeah, I mean, that 16% may be high, but let's just do a little very elementary math. I mean, the states that we're talking about, is the Trump plus 11 plus 12 states that the Democrats need to win the Senate: Iowa, Alaska, Ohio, Texas, and then Kansas, which actually Trump's margin in Kansas was the same as in Iowa. I don't know why people don't put Kansas more in the first tier, but anyway, and Florida, for that matter, a point worse. Those are states where Trump got, I think in almost every case, right around 55%, 55 or 56, mm-hmm. right, in those states. So let's do the math. Let's not say 16% of the Trump voters wouldn't vote from this time. Let's say it's 10%, as you were saying. 10% of 55 is 5.5, so that takes you down to 49, 50%.
Yeah.
For Trump now. Now, it's a little complicated. Not all of them will then vote for the Democrats. Some of them would just stay home, so the Democrat doesn't go up to 50 quite, even right. if Trump comes down. But it's in play.
It's in play.
Any state, if Trump is approval, or Trump, let's call it the Trump vote today, if there were a vote today, which is what they're trying to capture, that UMass poll. If the Trump vote today is at 48, 49, the Republican senators or Senate candidates in those states, whether it's Texas or Kansas or Iowa, et cetera, are at risk. And that's why that poll is, and look, and instead, this poll simply confirms, in a sense, other polling too. It's not like it's a weird outlier that, you know, there's plenty of state level polling that shows these races competitive. There's national polling that shows the generic Democratic edge up around 7-8, maybe a little more if you get to the really likely voters. So it's consistent with these states being in play. And I agree, that's why you shouldn't play prevent defense. And it's why, and it is encouraging though. I mean, that's, I don't know. Yes, you say, I'm a little dubious about these retrospective. You know, would you vote today for this and that? It's a little too easy to say. And the Senate vote isn't quite the same as the Trump vote. But the Trump car, you know, Ron Brownstein says this over and over. Susan Collins is the only senator in the Trump era, only Republican who has won a Senate race in a state where Trump was below 50% approval. And so if you can, knocking down Trump remains the most important thing, which again is a reason why the Democrats in Washington, they tell themselves this stupid story. We've got to get back to our district and campaign and back to our state because we're such persuasive people that if we show up an extra 3 days in that state, it's going to make a difference. The thing that's going to make the biggest difference is getting Trump's numbers down. And the way, one way to do that is to expose what Trump is doing in all of his failed policies.
Yeah. You really got my dander up now because, like, also there is a reversion to the mean sometimes, too, at the end of these races. Like, it can go either way, right? I guess this is what I'm saying. Like, sometimes there's reversion to the mean. There's data out there that says that, you know, Democrats, for whatever reason, have polled better in the summer recently. Like, we could give all kinds of theories on why that would be. But, like, if you're specifically talking about these red states, and like these voters, if you're at that number where Trump's at 49, right? Like every vote matters. And a lot of those voters, if they're not being pounded with negative Trump information between now and November, the easy thing is to say, ugh, we'll just stay home. I don't know. The Democrats are pretty crazy. Like, I'm just going to, you know, the left is a little too crazy for me. I'm just going to, you know, stick with my guns this one more time, or I'm not going to vote, right? Like, that is the easier thing for those people to do. So you really have to keep pedal to the metal on this stuff. And I think particularly around the war, you know, I just kind of not letting it get into the point where it's this like atmospheric noise and nobody's talking about it anymore because it feels like nothing's changed. It's like, no, people's lives are still being negatively impacted. Like the troops are still being, that are stuck there, still being negatively impacted, right? The gas prices, the fertilizer prices, like they got to keep driving this message. I agree. You should go to your district and do stuff, but like, they've had plenty of time in their district fighting it out in the national narrative and continuing to put Trump on his back foot. And tariffs, throw tariffs on top of that.
I totally agree. I think, look, you could obviously, in your paid advertising and in what they say back in their states, the Democratic candidates, tailor it to the states. So tariffs is a bigger issue in some of these Midwestern states where the farm economy has been clobbered by them. Very much worth focusing on that. The deportations, the ICE stuff in Ohio, I think is a very good issue to beat up Husted on, who's been timid and hasn't really said much one way or the other at this the grotesque stuff that's happening in Springfield. Florida, they're beginning to deport Venezuelans. I talked to a friend from Florida over the weekend who had been unhappy, he's where we are on these issues, unhappy that his fellow Floridians were not very alarmed by the immigration stuff. They didn't feel it was happening. There was that much happening there when all the news a year was in Minneapolis and then even before that in other places, California and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. But he said it's now hitting home. To get their numbers, to get Stephen Miller's 2,000 a day, you got to go after Venezuelans in Florida. That's a big TPS, formerly TPS, formerly protected category, who've been now made illegal. And, you know, people in Florida do not think it's a bad thing to have these Venezuelans working and living there and paying taxes and being law-abiding citizens and starting businesses and stuff. So you can localize the races to the degree that is appropriate in terms of issues. But yeah, you've got to keep the national pressure on. I really agree with you on that.
We have some breaking news since we've been taping. Trump has given them another issue that they can campaign on if they so choose. This is a bleat from Trump this morning. The only reason that communities throughout the USA should not want data centers is if they want to end up being backwards and poor. If they want to be successful and rich with far lower taxes and jobs all over the place, let the data reign.
Wow.
Okay. I have kind of some mixed views on the whole data center issue. It's more of a case-by-case issue for me. But that said, sometimes there's moments for good demagoguery. And this might be one of those with the Democrats. And I just as a strategic matter, like I've seen a lot of kind of wishy-washy kind of comments on this from Democrats. And like the numbers could not be clearer. Trump is giving them a gift. And again, it's just another issue where I think that if you just look at the numbers, there could not be a better opportunity for the Democrats right now if they took the mantle.
Yeah, and what you just read from Trump, of course, gives the Democrats the middle ground. As Trump is just for, you can't oppose any data center anywhere, apparently, but you're standing in the way of
Let the data rain.
So let the data rain. That should become a famous, you know, mission accomplished type phrase. The Democrats can say, look, we're for technological progress and we're for appropriate, you know, blah, 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 but we have to be regulated in local communities. And they can take it away. A middle ground, which probably is the sensible place to be in terms of policy.
And I'd be okay with them doing pitchforks.
They can also do a little pitchforks. That's a, you know, a third pitchforks, two-third middle ground. But Trump's given them a huge opening, right, by this extreme position, which is now like beyond the position of Governor Abbott in Texas. It's beyond the position of Republicans elsewhere running for office. It's beyond the position, at least the stated position, of the AI companies themselves, which are all like, we want to work with people and blah, blah, blah. You know, they know that that's a kind of suicidal everything. We can build whatever we want in secrecy at any scale we want, you know, with no limitations on anything at all. People are not for that, and they shouldn't be.
Jared, Abdul, like all of these guys, like really should be out front on this, though, and going after them. And to me, another angle to this that I think is politically useful is – this is just another example of Trump selling out to the big tech oligarchs that people don't like.
Totally.
You know? And so, like, regardless of if you don't want to get into the nitty gritty of the details of every data center and which ones are good and which ones are bad and which ones are terrible for the community and what rules we need, like, you can just go straight at it. Like, Trump, from his first, you know, Trump got elected saying that he was going to care about the forgotten man, and he's betrayed you, and he got in there in his inauguration. The richest people in the world sat in the first row, and he brought the richest man in the world into the White House. And now he's doing the bidding of the richest people in the world that want to get even richer by building these data centers. He doesn't care at all about what's happening in your communities and health concerns or environmental concerns or anything. He just wants these, you know, tech billionaires to like him. I think that's a pretty compelling message.
And he's in their pocket, right? Yeah, which sort of makes him weaker. You know what I mean? He's not, you know, he's their tool. You know, Elon Musk says jump and Trump says how high, you know?
Yeah. Well, Trump is pretty, he can't get that high, but, you know, hypothetically, I'd like to see Trump try to get off the ground with a little hop. Okay. Back to Laura Loomer. Now that my dander's up, I don't want to talk about the Michigan Senate race discourse. I just want to use Laura Loomer as a foil example for all the conversation around that, because Laura Loomer is herself a pretty unsuccessful podcaster, really. And she's a very successful influence operator. She does create content, but she's not at the top of the ranking. She's not a Megyn Kelly, Ben Shapiro. Oh, she's not one of these guys or women, but she uses her social media feeds to pressure the administration and to advise the administration. And she does so very effectively. I mean, she's basically successfully pushed out Mike Waltz as the national security advisor and a bunch of other people. Julia Gurley, who we had on the show, got fired basically because of a Laura Loomer campaign. You know, broken clock white twice a day. She did get Milo Yiannopoulos deported, it seems like, but that shows her influence. So, like, this is a very influential person that has the White House's ear that is pushing Republicans to hold the Senate. Here's some tweets from her just this weekend. This is about Angie Nixon, the Democratic candidate for Senate in Florida. I called you a ghetto bitch because you are, Angie, and your record proves it, but you speak Ebonics, though, so maybe I need to bark at you and tug your leash, and then you'll finally understand. She wrote about Randy Fine's speech. Randy Fine is the racist congressman from Florida. She wrote this: tonight at the RJC, Randy Fine is calling out mainstream Islam. Lots of cheers. Time for the GOP to read the room, speak up about the Islamic takeover of America or lose the midterms. Islam has no place in America. I would love to have cameras pointed at every mosque and preferably inside as well. Here's another one. When is Mehdi Hassan going to be denaturalized, Secretary Rubio? How can this Islamic invader be allowed to stay in our country? He should be deported immediately. So this is a very influential person, and I don't understand why every Republican running for office doesn't have to answer for this type of racism.
And this was in Florida, right? And she ran, actually, she isn't herself an unsuccessful, if I'm not mistaken, congressional candidate in Florida. Yeah, shouldn't the least, let's put the Florida incumbent senator who is, you know,
Ashley Moody.
Yeah, who inherited the seat, right? I mean, it's run for it. Up on the ballot for the first time against Angie Nixon, who I would not have voted for in the primary. I would have voted for Vindman. But I think she could be a better candidate than people think. I don't know.
I think it's a very tough race. But I think she's actually better for the other Florida Democrats than Vindman would have been, just looking at it purely. And like, she could kind of lift votes, I think, by creating some turnout. I think she's been very skilled in her interviews. Yeah, I agree with you.
Anyway, Moody, the senator, seems like she's trying to be sort of respectable and kind of low-key, kind of a Katie Britt type, I guess. Yeah. You know, I'm better than those Trump people. But of course, I'm totally on board. Put her on the spot. Does she agree with this? I mean, does she agree with Laura Loomer and Representative Fine there? And I agree. So this is where, again, going on the offensive and not simply playing prevent defense, important.
Oh, look, we've talked about this a bunch. I know you care about this. I care about rising anti-Semitism in the country. It's real. It's a problem. It should be called out. As bad as it's gotten, it's like hard to imagine a congressperson calling out mainstream Jews. Speak up about the Jewish takeover of America and lose the midterms. A Democratic congressperson could not survive that. And that's what a Republican congressperson is saying. And, you know, Jews have no place in America.
Right.
That is not the type of thing that you're hearing from even the concerning discourse on the far left. And like, she's saying this, Islam has no place in America, Mehdi should be deported. She's saying this with impunity right now. And it's fucking outrageous. Not to mention just the disgusting, like, anti-Black racism against Angie, telling her to bark. It's just really disgusting.
And, you know, and some of my friends, Jewish friends, my fellow Jews, kind of a little tolerant of the Islamic, the hate Islam stuff, but it's ultimately, of course, feeds into anti-Semitism. Once you legitimate it in one place, it's such a cliche almost to say at first they come for, you, but it really is true. Yeah. Once you legitimate this kind of racism or attack on people for their religious beliefs or just their religious origins, I guess you'd almost say, right, where they're from, it legitimates it elsewhere. Then you can't say the other side shouldn't do it. Then your own side starts to do it, incidentally, at the same time, and you're in a horrible place.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, maybe people should notice that the rise of anti-Semitism is real. And what has it coincided with? The rise of Donald Trump. Is Trump responsible for all of it? No. Is Trump himself particularly that way? Not so much on the Jews, because for various reasons. But, once you have a climate of hatred, it spills over in all kinds of ways. And that's what I do think has happened,
Yeah. I'd be interested in Mike Rogers' take on all these tweets. I wish somebody would ask him about it. While we're doing kind of the internal Dem primary stuff and the various factions, I did want to mention the Massachusetts Senate primary. Are we finally done with these, or do we still have New Hampshire ahead?
We still have New Hampshire, like Delaware. The New England, for some reason, is really into September primaries. I think New Hampshire's the only real one left, I think, after the Democratic.
It's been a slog this year. I'm not really looking forward to the next round, but okay, we'll see. I just want to mention the Seth Moulton-Ed Markey race. Well, I have some thoughts on it, but why don't I give you the floor first?
So I'm biased, because I'm a friend of Seth's and I've known him a long time. First met him in Iraq, where he was, as a lieutenant, one of Petraeus's kind of special aides. And when I went over in 07, they brought a few of us over there to see what the progress they were making on the surge. Seth was at the dinner we had with Petraeus. He then pinned our son when he went at the Marine Corps in 2009. So anyway, I go way back with Seth. So I'm totally biased, giving a little money to his campaign. He's behind in the polls. Ed Markey's 80 years old. Ed Markey has been in Congress, first the House, and then for the bulk of that time, and then the Senate, for 50 years. Ed Markey was elected to Congress before Seth Moulton was born. Now, if you think it's great to have it, and he's been an undistinguished, I think we can safely say, member of Congress for 50 years. It's not like there's like Ed Markey, a giant of Capitol Hill. So there we are. And I don't know, do Democrats want to be in the business of renominating undistinguished 80-year-old members of the senators, or do they want to have someone in his mid-late 40s he's not a great politician. That's why he may not beat Markey, honestly, because he's actually an honest and thoughtful guy, and he's not very good at the sound bites, and occasionally he says things and doesn't think through that maybe he shouldn't say this on that issue. Yeah. But he's an impressive person. He'd be very good for the Democratic Party to have in the Senate. I think he'd be good even in the campaign, in the sense that Massachusetts is going to be Democratic either way, but it would help with the general sense that the Democrats are the party of the future. And it's Tallarico and it's Moulton and it's Turek in Iowa and, you know.
And it's El Sayed.
And let's have there's some diversity. One or two I wish maybe hadn't been nominated, but whatever, there they are. It puts the Biden thing even more behind them, actually, which I think is kind of important politically. But mostly I think Moulton would be a very good senator. And he's behind in the polls. So, you know, like these primary polls are difficult. Obviously, Stevens was behind by whatever, 13, 15, and came within one or two. So I don't rule out Moulton winning. His campaign has all kinds of reasons. You'll be amused by this as a former campaign person. And they're friends of mine, so I'm not criticizing them. But they're, you know, our door knocking is going very well. And we're hearing really good. The ground game is really excellent. And I don't know. I've been in too many campaigns where the polls were bad, the ground game was good, and the polls are right. But so it could matter, you know, a reasonably low turnout September 1st primary. If the Moulton voters are more energized, that makes a difference. So I don't think it's out of the question that Moulton pulls an upset tomorrow night. And I think it'd be good for the Democratic Party if he did.
And the polls went back in both directions. Like, for example, that John Larson, who was an older House rep, was running against kind of a Moulton-ish Harvard mayor, a younger guy. And the polls had that as a coin toss. And the younger mayor, Luke Bronin, ended up killing him by like 20 points or something. And then you obviously on the other side, you've seen differences in the Michigan race. So we'll see how the polls turn out. My point about this, I have the benefit of not knowing either. I mean, I've talked to Seth a couple of times, but I don't really, you know, have a personal bias in this race. I don't have anything particularly against Ed Markey. But like, he's 80 years old and he's going to be 86 at the end of his term. People might think, oh, it's Massachusetts, it's safe, whatever. It's like Scott Brown won a Massachusetts special election that cost the Democrats like the public option in Obamacare. I mean, literally, if you care about that, like the fact that like they had to have a special election and then Scott Brown won that surprising special election. And that meant that Joe Lieberman or, you know, was the swing vote then in the Senate. It took the public option out of Obamacare. That result by itself. In this day and age, it could be something way worse than that, right? Like a Republican could win a Massachusetts governor. A Republican has been Massachusetts governor like 2 minutes ago, Charlie Baker. And so, you know, you have an 85-year-old guy in there in whatever it is, 2030, like in that midterm, you know, anything can happen. And it's also just kind of like, what? Who is he really the Senate? You know what I mean? Like his staff isn't really driving this. And I don't want to vote for Ed Markey's staff. I don't know what his chief of staff is going to be in 5 years. So anyway, I just think it's a practical matter. Like the Democrats turning the page. I'm less reticent than you on the El Sayed thing, which is fine. But like, I think to your point is like having Turek and Abdul and Moulton and Pappas in New Hampshire and Tallarico. And Angie, like that is a younger crop that is diverse, both demographically, but also ideologically, I think is better for the party. And I'd be for Seth tomorrow. So that's my take on that. I want to close with your newsletter this morning. You refereed the cabinet rankings that me and Sam did last week. And just to kind of remind everybody before we get to Bill's grade, where Sam and I landed. I feel pretty strongly about my position, but I'm open to feedback. And here it is. My ranking was worst Marco, second worst Hegseth, third worst Blanche, fourth worst Nutlick, fifth worst RFK Jr. Sam's list was Hegseth 1, RFK 2, Mark Wayne Mullen 3, Duffy 4, Blanche 5. You wrote this morning for the newsletter that we were both wrong. Tell us about that.
I mean, you were mostly right, of course. I just slightly adjusted it. You know, they asked me, oh, so many people, it was a wonderful show. You and people should go back and look at you and Sam. It's very amusing, but actually interesting in terms of your analysis for these different cabinet secretaries. And you're both slightly joking around. So I think Sam is just, Sean Duffy had been such a jackass in the last couple of weeks.
My Nutlick pick was literally as
dangerous as these people running these massive, important national security agencies. But so I take that point. So I was being a little bit of a cheap shot. for me to just kind of waft in and say, you know, let me be serious. But no, so mine was Hegseth worst. So I think they were pretty much in agreement, right? Sam had Hegseth worst and you had Hegseth second worst, but you wanted to make the point, which I think is a good point to make about Ruby.
We're going to come back to Marco. So do the rest. Okay. I want to end by arguing.
So Mullen second because of the atrocities of DHS. And I just talked to Jim Swift yesterday about what he'd seen in Springfield. Blanche third, obviously DOJ, terrible what's happening there. RFK Jr. again, doesn't need much explanation. And who did I have as fifth?
Rubio.
I had Rubio as a fifth, as a concession to your point that he's gotten a bit of a free ride. So do your Marco thing if you want.
Yeah, but I take your point on Mullen. I really should have had him fourth and not Lutnick, but you know, sometimes the content requires some embellishments. The mailbag. If you guys missed the Sam Stein episode last week, I know a lot of people are on vacation. You're skipping certain episodes, but like the mailbag at the end is really funny, and it's worth hearing about Sam's morning routine and some of the marital issues I might have created for him. But on the matter of Rubio, I received this text this morning from our friend Stan Voiger. Bill, we both received this text, actually. Bill, Tim is obviously right. Rubio is the worst member of the cabinet, and he didn't even touch on his central role in immigration policy. And thank you, Stan. I wanted to have this opportunity to revise and extend my remarks because I'm ranting about how terrible Rubio has been as a diplomat, as the head of Secretary of State, how terrible he's been as national security advisor. And I did neglect to mention that he was the one that orchestrated Sakat. It was him and... he went down to El Salvador, and obviously this is Trump, dude. These are all Trump's policies, but like Marco was the point man with Bukele on that deal. Marco was the point man on these deportations of people for wrong thoughts, whether that be Ozturk, you know, the op-ed that she had run, Ramesa Ozturk. So as he had been the one that was saying that like we should be taking away green cards for people if they express their free speech rights in a way that was not fully supportive of Donald Trump and Bibi Netanyahu, which is a total affront to the American experiment. It is not a gimmick that I have Marco as the worst. I genuinely believe that Marco has been the worst. And I do think that like, the fact that he gets the presumption of good faith or whatever, unlike some of these other guys, does exacerbate my feelings about it a little bit, I will admit.
No, fair enough. That's a good point. This is why the Bulwark is such a wonderful institution. We have a wide diversity of views.
So are you going to move him up the list or are you keeping him at fifth?
I could move him up a little. Just I hate to drop any of the others down. They're all so horrible. Like RFK Jr. Stuff I sort of personally follow less, but then I read Jonathan Cohen and I think, oh my God, he's doing unbelievable damage to our actually important things about the health of Americans, you know, and Blanche at Justice. So it's just hard to, Mullen, DHS.
It is.
It's tough. It's a real competition.
It's hard for me to not include Brooke Rollins, you know, Secretary of Agriculture. We have another item there. The defunding of the cyclospora research projects is hindering progress right now, you know, on the effort to prevent people of the country from having explosive diarrhea. So, like, it's bad all around. It is. So there is, you know, it's a judgment call on how to rank. But I want people to understand the Nutlick pick was a bit. The Marco Rubio is the worst cabinet member. I am 100% genuine about 1,000%. And if anything, I understated the case.
And some of our ex-friends, I'm sure, not that I'm in touch with that many of them anymore, but you and your ex-friends, in touch with that many of them anymore. They're in the, you know, well, look, Rubio, think we can be for him in 2028. But he's, that's really is kind of...
And everything can move forward.
It's a happy middle ground between accommodating Trump and being sane. And he's been, I mean, in that respect, he's more... horrifying. His accommodation and hypocrisy and everything is more, as a personal matter, I would say, is in a way more appalling than Hegseth, which just is what he is, right? I mean, yeah.
I agree. Hashtag never Rubio. That's where I'm at on this. We'll see how all that shakes out. Bill Kristol, we'll see you next week for a fun retrospective on 1994. I've started my research a little bit and I found some fun nuggets about Bill Kristol 1994,
Tim suckers me in by saying, well, have a good talk. I'll talk about 06. You'll talk about 94. We'll really talk about what a wave election's like. We'll help people understand it. It's all going to be, Bill, you said this embarrassing thing on September 13th, 1994. Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. Really looking forward to that.
We are going to do all of that and a couple of teases. Okay, everybody, thank you so much. We'll be back tomorrow with an old friend of mine. I'm excited to get on the podcast. And so we'll see you all then. Peace. The Bulwark Daily is brought to you thanks to the work of lead producer Katie Cooper, associate producer Ansley Skipper, and with video editing by Dante DiCicco and audio engineering and editing by Jason Brown.